Let's begin with prayer. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Food. We can't live without it, and heaven knows we love it. But whoever knew it could be so important to God? Not just for health and for the enjoyment and expression of culture and cuisine, but nutritionally and spiritually speaking, something as basic as food has a profound impact on the behavior, ethics, and values of religious people. How else would you explain the spiritual importance of fasting? Or what about this? If it were not so important theologically, why would our forebears in faith have labeled food clean and unclean? An odd ethical application, really. It's food that is the central element in the classic story of the entrance of sin into human experience. When God forbids eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the man disobeys and eats the forbidden fruit. Food is basic to the God-human relationship. The importance of food in a religious context becomes clear when in Leviticus 11:3, God says, "Any animal that has divided hoofs and is cleft-footed and chews the cud, such you may eat. But if beef is good, pork is not." Or so God says in Leviticus 11:7. The pig, for even though it has divided hoofs and is cleft-footed, does not chew the cud. It is unclean for you. Early in the process of getting the relationships with food squared away, God identifies clean and unclean food. And faithful obedience is then forever linked to appetites and behaviors born of one physical craving or another. Food rituals reveal what is sacred to us and what is proper and improper from God's perspective. Ramadan requires fasting. The Jewish people find story and identity in the Passover meal. And Christians gather at a table of bread and wine and remember a last Passover meal and look toward a heavenly banquet. Honoring and obeying God in the food that we eat is a daily concern expressed in the food wagons that line so many corners of our city, offering choices of halal or kosher food for those who want to grab a bite at noon and remain observant at the same time. Churches have applied ethical values to food these days. Many churches, for instance, take seriously the impact of serving fair trade coffee at the coffee hour and sell it to members who wish to have an impact, however small, on the economy of impoverished coffee growers. Who would have thought? The ethics of the coffee hour. A few years ago, there was a wag with good intentions who was going around giving reviews of churches. The gentle spirit or the unseen guest or the lost sheep, I forget the name. Oh yes, it was the mystery worshiper on the ship of fools. But he or she, and we never found out which, did reviews of churches in the city by slipping into the pew and rating the choir and the music and the preaching, the welcome at the door, services that went over an hour, whether there were children in the service, how newcomers were greeted, whether the preacher mumbled. And always there was a review of the coffee, whether it was too bitter or too watered down, made in metal high-volume percolators or not, which in the age of Starbucks might be something a church shopper would want to know. There it is again. Food, drink, and religion have always gone together. We live in a city of 24,000 restaurants in Manhattan alone. And as you know, they're all rated with an A or a lower rating, A being the only acceptable grade. And the inspectors go around and check things from time to time, evidence of rodents, warming table temperatures, that kind of thing. But after reading today's lesson from 1 Corinthians, I can tell you that the Corinthian church would have benefited if there had been a sticker put on the window of every restaurant and butcher shop in Corinth, especially those nearest to a pagan temple, and identify whether the meat sold there had been previously offered as sacrifices to pagan gods. Something simple, like a symbol of the pagan god with a big X through it in the middle of a circle, that kind of thing. That's the issue at the heart of this section that we read today from 1 Corinthians. And if you got a little confused in listening to Paul argue his case, it's because the wires of his microphone get wrapped around his legs as he walks in circles. He starts out his discussion on food by repeating what must have been a familiar saying: all of us possess knowledge. But then he actually starts to attack that understanding, because here, as elsewhere, he is very leery of any Christians who claim to have secret knowledge, knowledge of God that others did not possess. So while Paul begins his argument with a statement of casual common ground, don't think for a minute he's going to allow the Corinthians to have a Brahmin class of knowledgeable Christians who can eat meat, offer to idols, and wink because they know that it's not really important whether it has or has not been exposed to any pagan seasonings. Meat is meat, they would argue, and we as mature Christians know that the fact that the meat was once offered to a pagan idol has no meaning for a Christian who does not believe in pagan worship nor in the power of pagan gods. The whole 8th chapter in 1 Corinthians is given over to the expression of what defiles a person. And Paul argues that we all know that it's not what goes into a person that defiles them, but what comes out of them. Mean speech, for instance. Jesus, in his teaching of the disciples, makes this same argument about the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees who are fussing over the outside of the cup and not the inside. Here, Paul applies the same reasoning to the Corinthians. Stop worrying about meat offered to idols. The meat has not lost its essential meatiness, and it carries no special flavor or change in substance or mysterious power simply because it was used on a pagan altar as a gift once upon a time before it got to the restaurant plate. Of course, the Corinthians, as a guest in a pagan's home, might be faced with the odd circumstance of having put in front of her a meat sauce of unknown origins. And so the question would be, to eat or not to eat? That is the question. To be polite and smile and choke it down, or push it away and say, sorry, I'm a Christian. Paul says this is all idle concern. Sorry for the pun. But having made this point, Paul then says something that sort of throws out all that has gone before. He tolerates a description of those who are more naive in faith as being weak, meaning less strong and more easily influenced, and those who know that idol meat has no special power and can eat meat without impunity. But he argues a person who is strong in faith should not mislead a person weaker in faith who is not yet certain of what is the right or the Christian thing to do. Do they not, by eating pagan meat, lead the more immature in faith to do something that, though it may not be a sin, is nonetheless perceived to be so? In spite of all that Paul has said to defend eating anything you want, pagan idol meat or no, he concludes, if food is a cause of their falling, the weaker in faith, that is. Then I will never eat meat, so that I may not cause one of them to fall. And suddenly, this issue in front of the Corinthians is no longer a matter of food, of what you eat and what you don't or can't. And it's not about becoming a vegetarian or lacto-ovo or pescatarian or any of the other variations on the theme. Food is not the issue. What's the issue? The issue for Paul is the unity and peace of the church. If you don't have a church that is tolerant, no, forgiving and accepting and welcoming of one another, then what's the point of all the rules? Whether you eat meat offered to idols or not, whether you cross yourself or don't, whether you say debts or trespasses, whether you celebrate Easter or Christmas according to one calendar or a couple of weeks later according to another, what does all that count for if we cannot be kind to one another, respectful of our differences, helpful to the weaker in faith, and sensitive to the feelings of those who understand the faith a little differently than we do? You know, we serve grape juice at communion and not wine. Some of our Catholic and Anglican and Lutheran friends laugh at our fastidiousness, but Paul would say, if I cause any of my brothers or sisters who have issues with alcohol to fall, I will not drink wine. We started serving gluten-free bread in our communion plates a couple of years ago, and at first I got a few emails from folks who thought this was a little too cute by half. But in truth, I got one email, the deciding email, that I have not forgotten. One that said, now, after 70 plus years, I can at long last have communion with everyone else in church. And Paul would say, if by not including my brothers and sisters in the bread of life, so that all may partake, then I will not receive communion again until all may. Some time ago, a minister friend of mine told me about something that happened in her church. There was a leak in the choir loft up around the ceiling where the organ pipes were located. It was the end of the week and the end of the day, and the two construction workers who were repairing the roof had finished their hours. As a part of their precautions for the chancel, they put a drop cloth on the communion table. It being a Friday and no one in the church, they decided to play a round or two of poker. So they dealt the cards and played on their makeshift table. To add to the theme, they had opened a couple of beers and placed them on the table too, pulling up an elder's chair or two as well. About that time, a woman from the church who cleaned and tidied things for Sunday mornings, a member, straightening the materials in the racks of the pews and such, came through the sanctuary, her bucket and sponges and rags in hand. She paused for a moment to look at the roof workers dealing the cards and paying her no mind. Both of these fellows had been brought up in the church like her, confirmed, attended sometimes when they could, but there they were playing cards on the communion table on a Friday afternoon. And this woman, who volunteered to do small tasks to help the church she loved, gathered her thoughts and said to them, they gambled for his clothing at the foot of the cross, you know. And with that, the men folded up their cards, tossed their cans in the trash bag, and were on their way. Paul wrote to the Corinthians, if food is a cause of their falling, the weaker in faith, that is, then I will never eat meat, so that I may not cause one of them to fall. The issue is not food or drink, you see, or even playing cards in a little game after work. It's not about the fine points of whether you put the baby into grandma's baptismal gown on the baby's baptismal day. There's nothing more special about a vial of holy water from the River Jordan you bought for $10 in Israel than the water that Mr. de Blasio makes and comes out of the faucet and works fine for holy water. These outward signs are not the issue. It's the inward things that matter, whether we cause someone in the faith to falter or not. The point is not the food, Paul said to the Corinthians in so many words. The point is how we treat one another, how we honor one another, how we make sure that our actions do not hinder the faith of any others in the church. In just a little while, we're going to be meeting as a congregation for our annual congregational meeting. Lots of important business. Some of it joyful, some of it sad in one way or another, some of it a little scary because it has to do with change. And change is a word that we don't do very well in the church. Now, Mark Hostetter is the one of the four of us who always has three jokes in a sermon, but today I have one. The question is, how many Presbyterians does it take to change a light bulb? And the proper answer is, change? We Presbyterians may lack agility in change, but we have meetings down to a science. Old John Calvin trusted the members of the church, the elders, and those whom the congregation chose to lead them, to do well by one another and by God in the name of Jesus Christ. So as we prepare for the change that lies ahead of our congregation, let us do so trusting that we can and will take good care of one another, that we are entrusted to each other's safekeeping and care in Jesus Christ. This is something I remind you at every baptism, that we are given to each other's care. Nothing is quite as important as that. You've heard me tell this story before, but I'm told that at their last party, Henry James, of all people, bent down to give some advice to his namesake and young nephew, Billy. Three things in human life are important, he said. The first thing is to be kind. The second thing is to be kind. And the third thing is to be kind. Faith is how you live more than what you believe. So, Christian people, be kind. Be kind. Be kind.